card. Visit.
Good evening, folks. This is Attorney Mark Thompson. This is your Paul Revere Show. We are here every Monday night at 7 WAUK 540 AM 101 FM. You know, there's been a lot of talk about what's going on at the border, southern border, not so much the northern border, southern border of the United States. Immigration is always a hot issue. And I thought we should talk a little bit about it. This is the Paul Revere Show. We're always talking about how to keep Wisconsin moving forward. Last week, I had the representative talking about diversity in the state and what's going on. And I thought we should find out how immigration policy is impacting Wisconsin. I thought the best thing to do was to invite an immigration lawyer, Kane Houlihan, from the Houlihan Immigration Law, a fellow Marquette alum. Good evening, Kane. How are you?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
So you've been doing immigration law involved for over 15 years. You're a husband, father. You've been around the state paying attention. There's been a lot of discussion about hot issues, Title 42. What is Title 42 and what's going on in the southern border?
Yeah, I mean, we all need to know more about this. We're seeing news reports, but it doesn't tell the whole story. Title 42 is basically, it's an old law we've had on the books a long time about public health. And since we've all been through this public health emergency of COVID recently, well, the government used it as a way to turn people away from the southern border who were seeking to come in, oftentimes to seek asylum. So it was a justification for turning people back and refusing them entry into the U.S. based on the fact that we didn't want COVID-19 to spread. So it was, you know, partly a public health reason, but partly a lot of people see it as sort of a scapegoat or justification to be able to turn away people because we were having a lot more folks coming to the southern border than we've had in recent years.
So when you mention asylum, I mean, are you saying that asylum was a recognized vehicle for legal immigration before this Title 42?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been, you know, it's been legal to seek asylum in the U.S. for decades. I mean, look, after World War II, you know, we had lots of refugees coming here. And refugees and asylees are the same people, just a different name. So we've been doing this for a long time. It's been legal. It's always been legal. The things that change are, you know, our processes that we use to sort of serve people with the paperwork they need to come in and get the status or apply for the status. But it's always been legal to apply for asylum if you've been persecuted or have a fear you're going to be persecuted if we send you back to your country.
So what is going on the southern border right now? People are seeing visuals, you know, people coming up through Mexico. So what is it, what's actually taking place on the ground and what's sort of the story behind the headlines?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of reasons that there are so many folks kind of amassed at the Mexican-U.S. border, and they're coming from all over the place. They're not just coming from Central America anymore. That's been sort of the biggest area in recent years that people have come from, but there are people coming from South America and other countries too. And I mean, the real motivator of it all is that we're facing unprecedented violence and danger in a lot of these countries. And people are fleeing some really unsafe situations. So they're coming to seek safety in the United States, which has been historically a real beacon of hope for people seeking safety from, you know, dictators, from political repression. All different types of societal problems that are going on around the world and people are seeking safety. And the reason there are so many is that we can only process so many because we have a legal system. So we have a process people go through. Typically, someone would have an interview first with an officer at the border. We call it a credible fear interview just to see, do we believe your case? Is it at least believable? And, you know, does this seem legit? Are we going to go forward with the rest of the process seeking asylum, or is this someone who doesn't have a real case and we're going to turn them away?
So how does this situation on our southern border sort of impact, or how do you see it here on a day-to-day basis? Your office is in Milwaukee, right?
That's right. Yeah, I'm in Milwaukee. I've been here my whole career, and, you know, I serve immigrants all across the state, even some outside the state, but mostly in Wisconsin. And the way I'm seeing it is a lot of people find their way up here. Once they're released into the country to go to court and present their asylum case, they usually go and try to find a place where they've got family or some close friends that they can stay with, get established, get on their feet. And of course, we have an immigrant population here in Wisconsin, all over the state. And so I'm seeing asylum seekers come up and stay with family to get established and find jobs. Most of them tend to be in rural areas and small towns and communities across the state, although some do, of course, come to the cities like Madison and Milwaukee and Green Bay. But many, many, many of my clients, I'd say the majority, are living in rural areas, and largely they're working on the farms that, you know, we're very proud of here in Wisconsin. A lot of dairy farms. Without that immigrant labor, those farms wouldn't run. They just wouldn't have enough workers. And that's the reality here in Wisconsin. So I'm helping those folks try to win their asylum cases.
So let's sort of getting into the weeds a little bit. You know, like, who can qualify for asylum and how does the asylum process work? So, you know, listeners are watching, seeing, you know, watching people come up to the border. What is, you know, what's actually going on, and sort of walk us through that whole process?
Yeah, sure. Right. Because asylum isn't for everyone, right? It's a specific, you know, status that someone's asking for. So it's really to protect people who have been persecuted, which is just another way of saying harmed. They've been harmed, or they have a real fear they're going to be harmed if they're sent back. But that harm has to be because they're part of a protected group. You know, that harm has to be because of their race, their religion, their nationality, their political opinion, or because they're part of a certain social group. So we have these categories that someone has to fall into. It's not just that they're in danger or they're going to be harmed just because everyone's in danger in that country. So it's very specific, and you have to say, well, I'm going to be harmed because I'm a racial minority, or I'm a religious minority maybe, or my politics don't line up with the government in power at this time and I'm being persecuted. So that's sort of the type of person who's applying. Now, when they apply, if they've been processed by immigration, they're going to go into immigration court and present their case to a judge, and the judge is going to decide. If they get in here either with a visa or some other way and they're not detected at the border, they can apply and they'll have an officer look at their case first. And if they don't win with the officer, it'll go to the judge.
If someone is looking for information, where do they go to find out about their rights or whether they qualify for asylum or not?
I mean, that's a great question, and it's really tough. I mean, folks are coming here, they're desperate, they've just fled some kind of dangerous situation. They don't speak the language oftentimes, so it's hard. Now, at the border, the officers do provide them with some information. They provide them with some, and they have this in most languages, so some basic rights. They do provide them a list of free legal services, although I can tell you those legal services are usually very hard to come by because there's such high demand. But they're really going to find an attorney like me who knows about this stuff and can advise them, or some type of nonprofit organization that's helping immigrants and asylum seekers, which there are a number of really great ones out there, but they tend to be you know, at capacity. They're really working hard and they can't serve everyone. So some people don't ever find out. So it's very challenging for new arrivals who are seeking asylum.
So, you know, I hear people talking about we have open borders and people can just walk across. What is that myth or fact, or, you know, how should we as citizens here in Wisconsin, you know, view that issue?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do this every day for, you know, over a decade, and I can tell you there's no such thing as an open border. We don't have an open border. There are certainly, you know, all kinds of issues we could debate about whether the border is secure enough, but we have a lot of enforcement. Customs, the Border Patrol is the largest law enforcement agency in the United States. So we have a lot of enforcement happening. And in fact, under Title 42, over 2.5 million people were turned away from the border. So there is a process. It's not perfect, you know, but there is absolutely a process. Most people seeking asylum actually aren't trying to cross illegally. They're turning themselves in at the border and asking our officers, please help me. I'm really scared to go back to my country, which is absolutely legal for them to do. You know, like I said, seeking asylum has been legal here for many decades, and that's all folks are doing. They're just asking for safety.
You know, there was this talk that there was going to be a complete collapse at the border. What's the reality, and, you know, what are we seeing beyond the hype and the pictures?
Yeah, I mean, that didn't happen. At least it hasn't yet, and it doesn't seem like it's going to. The officials down on the border are processing high numbers of people, more than we typically do. I think for a while we were averaging about 10,000 people a day. But there are a lot of people amassed at the border still waiting to get through, and it seems like they are, waiting in order to have their chance to ask our government for its protection. To go through the legal process, whether they get a credible fear interview or just are released in and then talk to a judge and ask for asylum. So that's kind of what's going on right now. We have to keep watching it. Every day can change, right?
So this is Attorney Mark Thompson. This is the Paul Revere Show. We are here every Monday night from 7 to 8, WAUK 540 AM 101 FM. I am here with Attorney Kane Ulahan of Ulahan Immigration Law. And we're talking about immigration, changes in immigration, the issues. We'll be right back to talk more. Welcome back. This is Attorney Mark Thompson. This is your Paul Revere Show. We are here every Monday night at 7 to talk about how do we keep moving Wisconsin forward? How do we build a better, stronger democracy? How do we go about forming a more perfect union? And I thought that given all the talk about the border and what's happening, I would have a guest, Kane Ulahan, and we have a little technical glitch here. So I just wanted to share a story. Kane Ulahan has been working for 15 years as an immigration lawyer. He has focused his work on trying to facilitate and make this a much better state. We talked a little bit about what was going on with the immigration and asylum issues, and how as people apply for asylum because they are facing persecution at home, that they are allowed to legally apply for asylum. And if they qualify, they're allowed to work. And, you know, it's very important that folks realize that these issues and these folks that are trying to get across our border seeking democracy are aware that they are able to work. And I think for the rest of us is to realize that this is not illegal immigration. And so, Kane, we figured out this little technical glitch.
Sorry about that.
Here, let's just talk about, though, when you qualify for asylum, are you able to work? So, I mean, what is this process? Because there's so much, everybody thinks this is like illegal. People are coming here, right? We know that there are a certain percentage that are illegal, but this asylum issue in this Title 42, it addresses a legal right to come in.
That's right.
So if you qualify, what happens?
100%. So if you have a legitimate claim for asylum, you make your application, and then after waiting a few months, you're able to apply for a work permit. So then you're granted this work permit, and then you can legally work in basically any job. So we've got, you know, many, many people here seeking asylum, legitimate claims, and now they're able to work legally too, which is filling a really big need we have in our economy. I mean, everyone knows. I see it all the time. I'm sure you do. Employers are looking for employees. They can't find enough workers. Here we've got people in a legitimate process. But in the meantime, they want to work. And they are hard workers. They are dedicated. They're reliable. And I see it all the time. I mean, think about it. These asylum seekers have to pay legal fees to work with someone like me. And they make it work. They work oftentimes low-wage jobs. And they're grateful to do it because it's an opportunity that they don't have otherwise. And they're safe. So they're not in the country where they've been threatened or harmed. And they're working, they're contributing to our Wisconsin economy, and they're keeping our farms running, frankly.
So tell me about that. When you say they keep our farms, our dairy farms, you know, that's our brand in the country, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The dairy state.
Green Bay Packers, cheese and milk. So help me understand to what impact, you know, are immigrants playing on our farms, and how does this asylum situation really, why is it really important for folks in Wisconsin, especially folks outside of the cities?
Yeah, absolutely. For many, many years now, our farms in Wisconsin and, you know, our dairy farms have depended on immigrant labor. I'd say well over 80% of dairy farms are immigrant labor. Many of those are undocumented. And now there's been a shift too. I mean, there are less migrants coming from Mexico than there used to be. And a lot of them are getting more established and moving on to other types of jobs. Those mostly Mexican workers, there still are Mexican workers on dairy farms, no doubt, but there are less than before. And that need, that sort of hole is being filled largely by asylum seekers, many of whom are from Central America. So that's what's going on right now in Wisconsin. And people oftentimes don't see that backstory to it all. We just see the headlines about the border, but all that has a trickle-down effect into our communities and our economy. And our identity is the dairy state, right?
Yeah. It is, we think about the Statue of Liberty, right? As the beacon of recognizing, you know, my grandparents came from Denmark. Europe, it was, you know, disaster time, and people came looking for a new start. With all the talk about Title 42, and we have, you know, a couple minutes left, or maybe not even that much, what's up with the Dreamers, right? Yeah. There was this idea of the Dream Act, and what is that briefly, and where are the, you know, where are the Dreamers in this?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got so many young immigrants who, and some are not that young anymore, just immigrants who were brought here as children. So it wasn't their choice, it was their parents' choice, but they have this country has become their own country. They don't know oftentimes the country they came from. I've had many clients who came here as babies, so they have no recollection of the country they came from. The U.S. is home for them, but they don't have a legal paper. They don't have status. And so over the years, we've tried to, Congress has tried to pass a DREAM Act to give legal status to those young folks that we've now called Dreamers. And they've come very close to passing it, but it never has. So we have DACA, which is the program that started under the Obama administration, and that's still there. So basically, some people are under DACA. They got a work permit, but they don't have anything permanent.
Thank you, Attorney Kane Ulahan of Ulahan Immigration Law.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, folks. This is Attorney Mark Thompson. This is your Paul Revere Show. We are here, WAUK 540 AM 101 FM, every Monday night at 7. We just got done talking to a Marquette lawyer, Kane Ulahan, on immigration, and I'm delighted to say that I have another Marquette lawyer joining me right now, Evan Goyke. How are you, Evan?
I'm doing great, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, we folks, I asked Evan to be here. He is the rep for the 18th Assembly. He is a key, I guess the term is the ranking Assembly Democrat on joint finance.
It just means old. Yeah.
No. Folks, what it means is that there are, it's a small committee and they're talking about what we're going to do with our budget and what we're going to do with what, $6 billion plus in surplus and all the policy and debate that's going on. And I thought it would be great to have you, Evan, to give us just sort of the latest update from the trenches so the listeners are knowing what's going on with our taxpayer dollars and what policies are at issue and, what's going to happen in this state? And are we going to be moving forward or not? Right. So,
yeah, no, it's perfect timing. Thank you for having me on again. The budget's the most important thing the legislature does every session. We have budgets in Wisconsin that last 2 years. For context, the last 2 years operating budget of about $85 billion, healthcare, schools, roads everywhere. I mean, it touches every single aspect of people's lives, which is why I say it's the most important thing. We are right in the middle of the debate. Governor introduced the budget February 15, month of April. The Joint Finance Committee went around the state. We met in person. 1,400 people came to our committee to tell us their thoughts. About 3,000 more sent in letters, emails, phone calls, et cetera, to my office. So really strong engagement for folks. And now in the month of May and the month of June, the legislature's debating the budget. So here's how it goes. I mean, I'll give you the real, cut and dry version. The governor has introduced a budget that sets the benchmark. What does a successful budget look like? And what happens in the months after that is the legislative Republicans who disagree with some of the items the governor has prioritized, they spend their entire spring and summer catching up to that mark that the governor set. And it is a real pleasure to work with Governor Evers and his team and his budget office. They have put together a document this year that I think really meets the moment. We've got this, what we sometimes call unwinding of COVID, right? We're coming out of a couple of years where the federal government really stepped up and have helped people with health care and food share benefits and child care benefits. And a lot of that is going away. And so part of this budget is really defined by how Wisconsinites are going to step up and help one another out now that that federal relief is going away. So we're in the midst of Tuesday, May 2nd, 2 weeks ago, the Republicans started the debate. Unfortunately, they took a very partisan approach to the first day of the budget debate by removing a number of the items of the governor's budget, 545 to be exact, the most ever. So I really look at it as the most partisan way to go about debating the governor's budget. But what we know is what I said. Look, governor puts out this benchmark. He sets the goalpost. What is success? And we are dragging the Republicans. They're inching, crawling, limping, however you want to say it, to meet the mark that the governor has set. So This week, Joint Finance is talking about how courts are funded and prosecutors and public defenders, a criminal system that really has struggled and needs a lot of help. The lawyers in those in the real trenches are really in need of a raise. They've earned it. And then on Thursday, we're debating clean water and a lot of agricultural support that we do for our ag community. And I mean, these are you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in agriculture. So we're right in the thick of things. And the goal is to have the budget done by June 30th. So in the next couple of weeks, I think your listeners can, every day there's going to be a new development to plug in and to learn about.
So, you know, there's been a lot of talk on shared revenue and local control and local government and how the you know, the surplus gets divvied up. Yeah. You know, I'm a little older than you. So I was a steel worker for 8 years. And, you know, I just remember it was just, if you were blue collar then, and this was like, you know, late 70s, that's 1970s, right? No, but we had health insurance and we had pensions, and people knew that if they worked hard, they could save money and they could buy their own cabin up north. And I listen to young people, and people can't even dream and imagine that kind of middle class. So what happened, and how does this, the budget and the, you know, the removal of these 545 items, how does that impact people, right? I mean, if you're just hard working, right, you're not a lawyer like me, what's at stake?
You know, it's really hard to summarize, because the budget is, it impacts everybody's life in different ways. One of the most important decisions that the Republicans did was to continue the partisan attack and refuse to expand Medicaid. And when we say expand Medicaid, we talk about expand the income eligibility mark. And what we're really targeting is the people that are working, but not working, and not, they're not offered a benefit at their workplace, and they're not making enough to be able to afford health insurance. And sometimes you're talking, it's a pretty big expense. We're talking about people that make $17,000, $18,000, $19,000 a year, having the government come in and step in and help them with subsidized health insurance through expansion of Medicaid. And there are a lot, your listeners probably know, this has been a fight that we've been going on for a long time. We're one of 10 states in America that hasn't expanded Medicaid. We receive billions of dollars in federal aid, so it pays for itself. And it's become ideological because the Republicans call it welfare, but we're talking about working people. Right. I mean, we're not talking about people with zero income. They're covered already. We're talking about people in that next income tier up above 100% of the federal poverty guideline. So they got a job. They got income. They're trying. But you see this in so many different areas. That's really the biggest piece to talk about. But you see it in transportation, housing. You know, the Republicans cut, added money in transportation, added money to affordable housing. School. There were provisions that would make college free for kids that are coming out of working class families, right? So these are all ways that we know work to help people climb up that economic ladder that you're talking about. And it's slipperier and slipperier in America, right? You mentioned pension. It's an evaporating thing in the private sector, a thing called a pension. There was a provision in the governor's budget that would have helped every privately employed person in Wisconsin have a retirement savings account. There's about 1 million working people in Wisconsin that have a job that doesn't offer them a 401k or a retirement account. And Republicans stripped that out of the budget.
So you've been you've been kind. I call one of the Republicans King Boss. Okay, it's just remarkable to me that someone that, you know, is one of 99, but acts as if he is a king. And, you know, I know you're working and I don't mean to get into this, but where does the money go? We're talking about a surplus, yeah. Right? So if it's not going to working people, where do they want the money to go to?
Well, I expect them to have an income tax cut of some form, probably an income tax that would give a cut to the higher income earners. It's the exact opposite of what we've just been talking about. The governor had proposed a 10% tax cut for people making 100 grand or less, or 150 grand or less for a married household. That would have given tax relief to over 2.5 million Wisconsin families. I mean, just that's targeting the middle class. I think the Republicans will have a tax cut that favors the wealthy. So that'll be a big chunk of it. You know, there's some agreement that there are one-time expenditures. You know, the state pays for like the University of Wisconsin system and the prison system. Anytime we need to build something like a new dorm or a science building on campus, we usually borrow money for that. I think there's agreement between both parties that using some of that one-time money is a good idea to build stuff. It's like buying a house without a mortgage. And if you can avoid those future expenses, you free up money in future budgets. And so the governor actually recommended using almost $2 billion of the $7 billion surplus for that purpose. And what we know is over 20 years, that would have saved $800 million. So there might maybe the Republicans agree with that. I don't think they're going to meet the mark that the governor has put out there. Look, Mark, I think they're going to sink money into places that they that they've prioritized. Then I do hear the water cooler to kind of pull the curtain back. They right. know they know they've got to do something to get the governor's attention, right? I mean, Tony Evers was reelected in November of 22 by three times the margin that he was elected in 2018. You know, April was a really good election for Janet Protasiewicz, 11-point victory. They know they got it. They know they're not on a winning track record here. Now, they've also sold their soul to interests that, you know, may not let them go far enough. So that's the tension. If you want a real view of what's happening in the trenches, it's the tension between the governor and the mark that he has set, and the Republicans who don't want to spend money, but know they've got to spend money. Boy, public school funding is going to be the most important marker here. The governor's got the biggest, most robust investment in our public school system ever, the biggest increase ever proposed. Republicans, we'll see what they do. That's going to be a real test to see what happens with this budget debate, like to forecast whether or not we have a successful budget that the governor is going to really feel compelled to sign. I think you could look at public education coming up in the weeks ahead as a marker.
You know, I think that it's, to me, when I hear you say that, it's like, how can we not spend it on the kids? You know, I'm looking at grandkids now that are in the public schools in Milwaukee. But we're also looking at, you know, AI, and I'm looking at, you know, the world is going to change so quickly. And if we don't have our kids educated and on the cutting edge, they're not going to be able to compete.
I totally agree with you.
I don't understand the rationale for gutting our kids' future.
No, and you saw in the fall election public education more politicized than on the right. You know, you've seen school board candidates and banning books and going after all the kind of buzzwords and red meat on the right. But you had Tim Michaels openly talking about cutting public education again. And, you know, he was trounced by Evers. Mark, look, you, I couldn't agree with you more. These are seeds that take a while to bear fruit as well. When you cut public education funding or when you invest in it, it takes years for the impact of that, right?
A kid starts at five and then, you know, it's 13 years later.
That's right. Well, and years ago, almost a decade ago now, the Republicans really, 10 years ago, they slashed public education funding, and you see it in the hallways today. It all goes back to those decisions. And so this is a moment to make up for cuts done 10 years ago. And as you say, and rightly point out, it's a time of a historic surplus. So if we cannot agree on really historic investments for kids now, I mean, so that's really a big marker. I mean, that a real test to see whether this can be a successful budget or not, it's going to be public education.
The I sense just, you know, Governor Evers, he came out of education. He's always been a believer in children and the future. How do you see that playing out? I mean, you know, the country, look at, if you're outside the cities, public education is all you've got, right?
Yeah, and often the largest employer in the city of the town, the county. So look, it's Evers' biggest priority in this budget.
It's all right.
Biggest priority in the budget.
Attorney Mark Thompson, I am here with Rep. Evan Goyke. We will be right back to talk more. It's got to be done before then. Welcome back, folks. This is Attorney Mark Thompson. This is your Paul Revere Show. I am here with Representative Evan Goyke. He was elected in 2012 to the Assembly, so he's a seasoned veteran now at the politics in the state. He worked, he's a husband, he's a father, he was a public defender, he was adjunct professor of law at Marquette University Law School. He is a Marquette Law alum. I'm a Marquette alum, so I've got a lot of respect for Evan. And we spent some time talking about joint finance and the latest, but the rumor is you're also thinking about maybe running for another office. Is that a true rumor?
It is a true rumor. I am a filed and declared candidate for city attorney in the city of Milwaukee with an election date in April of 2024, so about a year from now.
So the tell us, why are you running for city attorney? And also, I'm going to put it this way, because you're bringing all this joint finance knowledge from Madison. How does that impact how you think about the city, how you understand the relationship between the city and the state, and why the city attorney, and how does that work for Evan Goyke?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So I'm going to kind of mix in, I think, hopefully answers to all this. It's been partly my experience as a state representative that I've gotten to work with the city attorney's office, really exposed to the work that the assistant city attorneys do. And specifically, a number of years ago, we worked on legislation regarding foreclosed homes. And we worked on a bill that I authored that ended up passing and getting signed into law that made it more difficult for landlords that weren't paying their taxes or fixing up their properties from buying more properties. We had this basically unregulated cycle where problem landlords would lose a house, buy a house, and the poor people in the neighborhood were left in the wash cycle, right? And so I got to work with assistant city attorneys frontline. This is what they were doing. They were trying to keep the neighborhood in my community, in my neighborhood, actual neighborhood on my block. And I got to know them and got to know what they did. And I thought, that is a damn cool job. What they got to do and the aid at the city attorney's office is responsible for a lot, but specifically that experience that could really impact a lot, the quality of life, public safety, value of the neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. So I pay attention to the office. It's not something that I've, most people in politics would not say. They couldn't list what the city attorney does necessarily. But what we've seen in Milwaukee in the last couple of years is what happens when, in my opinion, when the office is under somebody that's not capable of managing the law firm. Good, seasoned attorneys have left. There's been vacancies. It's been pretty chaotic. And what the result has been is missed deadlines in court, inability to, process things as simple as a development contract or giving a legal advice to the city council so that they can enact policy as they are elected to do in a timely manner. That has affected everything from high-rise developments on the lakefront to reckless driving ordinances that impact, you know, neighborhoods across the city. So I've took a really long, hard look at the power and the role and the importance of that office. And I think my skill set is a good match. My time in the legislature has really exposed me to this huge, wide array of issues that face the city and how the city attorney and the city attorney's office are intertwined in those really critical issues.
So, you know, you talked about housing. How does the city attorney impact that issue? And, you know, how does that, you know, what percentage of the population in the city are we talking about? And also then, how does that ripple countywide and statewide?
Yeah, and it's the city attorney is not just it's not just like a law firm for anybody that walks in. It represents the city as an entity, and specifically in housing, the Department of Neighborhood Services is the city agency tasked with enforcing building codes, and on the outside and on the inside at times. And the city attorney is essentially the prosecutor. So it's not a perfect analogy, but think of the Department of Neighborhood Services as the housing cops, and the city attorney as the prosecutor for those housing cops. And what we've saw in the last administration is the use of an existing law, so it's nothing that I'd create, called receivership. And basically, they make the argument to the court that these landlords are making huge amounts of money and not paying the fines issued against them and not following the court's order to fix up their property. And receivership just basically says, we're going to take the rent and we're going to fix what's wrong with the house that you own before you can cash that rent check. And let me tell you, Mark, it caught the attention of landlords throughout the city of Milwaukee because it hit them on the bottom line. And we're just talking about bad landlords. I'm not talking about every single landlord. I'm talking about people that don't keep up their properties and don't give people a decent place to live. How that impacts the community is massive. We're talking about little kids growing up in quality housing to make sure that they're lead free, lead paint, lead water, that the condition of the house, it impacts public safety. Often these properties become nuisance for criminal activity, drags down your house value and my house value, and that impacts the city in the property tax base. More broadly, the healthier the neighborhoods of the city of Milwaukee, the healthier Milwaukee County and the state of Wisconsin is. So this is going to be a huge priority of mine when elected. The city attorney cannot impact every single aspect of life in Milwaukee, but this housing issue is directly square in their wheelhouse and their authority. We have existing law that can benefit the people. We just need a city attorney willing to use it.
So along this theme, you're looking at running a city attorney, but you're right now on joint finance as the ranking assembly Democrat. You got like 30 seconds. What's the lessons about this budget, this money, and the city?
We have a challenge. We got to meet the moment. We have divided government, so there is a possibility to find consensus. Got to be willing to give a little and get a little. We haven't had many fair deals for Milwaukee in my 11 years in office, and I am hopeful that this is an unprecedented moment where we can deliver the type of aid or resources necessary that every neighborhood in Milwaukee can thrive. So I am optimistic moving forward, but damn, we got a lot of work to do to make sure it happens right.
Well, Representative and Attorney Evan Goyke, thank you so much for joining us. This is Attorney Mark Thompson. This is the Paul Revere Show. We'll be back next Monday night at 7, WAUK 540 AM 101 FM. And folks, keep this great state moving forward. We cannot go backwards, folks. For the kids.